for the week of May 13th, 2018. This is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 409, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Cannes, France, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
Well, rub that in, why don't you? In New York, I'm Michael Gills.
How are you, Michael?
I'm fine, and future historians will be all a tremble over the great lost episode of Showbiz Sandbox.
Yeah, you might be wondering, because we did say that we were going to record last week's show and then post it. We did actually record last week's show. However, we did not post it because then when we went back to actually listen to it, it was not actually, well, we were recording, but it did not sound good at all. There was some...
There was a howl of despair from Sperling.
Yes.
Right after we finished the show, because that's happened before, and we've actually re-recorded the entire episode. We've done it once or twice probably over the years where there's been some weird snafu. This time we just didn't have the ability because you were headed off to France.
Right. I was actually, if you recall, I was in France.
Ah.
At the time. I was actually, you know, I had just arrived. The Cannes Film Festival was just about to start. The opening night screening was just minutes away, and I had to run off to it.
Oh, the excitement. Is it sunny, France? Because it's been rainy here for the last few days in New York.
Well, it was sunny up until yesterday, when all of a sudden it decided that monsoon weather is really what the festival needed to pick it up.
I think in the future, somebody will do a term paper or a scholarly essay on the differences between the episode we recorded last week and the episode we released this week. You know, they'll parse out the distinctions and what was covered and what wasn't and what nuance did they add to it because they had the extra week to mull it over. And it's going to be, I think, ripe for, you know, exploration for years to come.
It'll be like those Beyonce performances that would have happened in 2017 if she weren't pregnant. You know, they would have happened at Coachella in 2017, but instead happened at that music festival in 2018.
It will be exactly like that, except less attractive and less talented.
And without the marching band. Yeah.
And without the marching band. How? Well, we don't know. We get to the end of the show. Maybe there'll be a marching band. But that's what people would have talked about last week. But what are we going to talk about this week?
This week on Showbiz Sandbox, we've got fresh croissants, espresso coffee, and the latest news from the Cannes Film Festival. Then after Michael stops crying over being in the United States, or as they say in France, les États-Unis, we'll move on to the rest of the news. In China, a new service called Smart Cinema promises to collapse windows completely. It offers people the option to stream a new movie in theaters onto their cell phone for the price of a movie ticket. Oh, Christopher Nolan must love that. Somewhere, by the way, a Hollywood studio executive joined Michael in a crying jag over that last piece of information. The Chinese box office hit Us and Them is being sued for falsely inflating the demand for tickets to secure more screens, and that helps explain why Hollywood is wary of letting MoviePass get between them and their customers. You didn't think we'd forget about MoviePass, did you? Yeah, we haven't. They've switched back to their classic original plan and hotly insist the company is not dying. Apparently, there was a news report that they were dying, but they're not dying, okay? So everybody just chill out.
Stop saying they're dying.
Yeah, for Pete's sake. During Book Filter, you'll hear the latest about the Nobel Prize for Literature, and author Philip Roth can sleep in this year. In sexual misconduct news, we've got lawsuits aplenty, including Ashley Judd suing Harvey Weinstein, Roman Polanski threatening to sue the Academy, and an ugly lawsuit involving Universal. On Inside Baseball, we take a closer look at theme parks in China and whether that suggests the future of Hollywood movies in the Middle Kingdom. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover the week's top entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right, and we're looking at box office around the world. We have a link to Comscore in our show notes. We also pull information from Box Office Profit, Box Office Mojo, Variety, The Hollywood Reporter, The New York Times, The LA Times, you name it. And the number one movie around the world is The Avengers Infinity War Part 1. So much money this weekend, I thought it was a mistake. $343 million worldwide. Thank you, China. $1,606 million worldwide. Records continue to fall for the Marvel movie.
It's absolutely amazing to me. That amount of money for that movie is, I mean, it's going to break the $2 billion mark, I think.
Oh, absolutely. you know, unless China collapsed in the second weekend, it certainly will. It still made $60 million this weekend in North America, so it's still got probably another $100 million to make in this country. And Black Panther is poised to just pass, I think, the $700 million mark at the North American box office alone. So the Marvel movies continue to just rake up tons and tons of money. And number two around the world is the Melissa McCarthy back-to-school sort of comedy, Life of the Party, $21 million on its opening weekend. That's on a $30 million budget. Like all the movies she makes with her husband, Ben Falcone, it's been pretty poorly reviewed and sort of a lesser hit, but this one's doing all right. It's in 9 territories so far. At number three around the world is Overboard. This is kind of interesting. This is the film co-starring Eugenio Derbez. It made $18 million this weekend. It had a really good hold in North America. It's at $41 million worldwide. It opened up in Mexico. And it's a film geared towards Latin audiences, appealing to them in the casting, but not a Spanish language film. And it's paying off. They're turning Derbez into a star in North America. He's already a star in Central and South America and Spain, I assume. And this is a remake that really worked. The gender flip, the Latinx appeal has really paid off for this movie. At number four is Breaking In, the Gabriel Union thriller, also opening up here in North America and 5 other territories. It made $17 million on its opening weekend, just under $18 million, which is great because it cost about $6 million to make. So that movie is in the black right off the bat. You know, it's looking solid for a low-budget thriller. This one has delivered. At number five is Rampage, starring Dwayne Johnson, another $10 million on the weekend. This movie has really underperformed in North America. It's not going to make it, I don't think, even to $100 million in the U.S., but it's at $400 million worldwide, so it's going to be okay.
Yeah, Dwayne Johnson movie doing well. Yeah, that's, you know, worldwide, internationally, that does not shock me at all.
At number six is the John Krasinski film, A Quiet Place. The horror flick made another $9 million. $270 million worldwide for the guy from The Office whose debut directorial film was Interviews with Hideous Men. I mentioned that because I was at Trivia on Wednesday and I didn't get that question right.
Oh, that hurts.
That really hurts. I was very, if they'd only said the guy from The Office making a horror flick, I would have been okay. At number seven is the horror flick Blumhouse's Truth or Dare. $8 million on the weekend, $70 million worldwide. At number eight is I Feel Pretty, starring Amy Schumer, $7 million for her new comedy and $60 million worldwide. At number nine is the Sherlock Gnomes flick, the animated movie. That's also at $70 million worldwide. And then at number 10, the Chinese film, we've got a little bit more to talk about. It's Us and Them, directed by Renee Liu, a.k.a. Milk Tea. And that made another $4 million. That's at $205 million worldwide. So if you wanted to get into the top 10, you had to gross $4 million. If you wanted to get on the charts at all, you had to gross about $1 million, because that's where our film at the bottom of the charts at number 25, that's what that grossed. And Milk Tea had a hit with Us and Them, no doubt about it. They're suing, actually, claiming that Us and Them pumped up its pre-release hype by claiming more tickets were being bought in advance than actually were true, and that cost other movies screens at the Chinese box office.
Yeah, so basically what happens is, in China, a lot of tickets are sold via mobile. So about 80 to 90% of all tickets are sold via mobile, and with Us and Them, they sold a lot through pre-sales, but they allow chargebacks, or they allow refunds, and the average refund rate for movie tickets for, you know, the average title is 0.05, 0.04%.
In other words, some people might buy a ticket and then decide not to go, and they can get a refund without worrying about it, and that happens rarely, if ever. So if you buy a ticket in advance and decide you can't make it, you're allowed to get your money back, but it's very rare. It happens almost less than 1%.
Correct. However, for Us and Them, there were lots of advanced tickets being sold. So exhibitors, movie theater owners, they started adding extra screenings, and then all of a sudden there's a 6% refund rate. So it's like 500% above where the average refund rate is.
Right. So basically what happened is the people behind the movie, the claim is that they bought lots of pre-sale tickets and then they knew they could refund themselves. So they spent, you know, say in the US would be $9 million, $9 a ticket. So say they sold $10 million worth of tickets to themselves, and then they refunded the money just to hype the movie, make, oh, look at all the pre-sales, because we get that all the time. Han Solo, oh, the pre-sales have been huge. You know, they talk about that a lot, and it helps people say, oh, I want to see the movie. It's pre, I better buy my ticket now. So they hyped the movie. This is the argument. They hyped the movie. They bought lots of tickets knowing they could refund themselves right away, because 6% is a huge return rate. That's much, much higher than usual, and that made other people say, oh, it's a big movie. And so theaters gave it more space. Other people didn't buy tickets to other movies, or they couldn't. You know, it's a scam, basically, is what we're talking about.
Yeah, because other producers and other distributors, well, granted, there's not too many distributors in China, but the other films couldn't get screen space because Us and Them was taking it up due to a false demand. It was a huge movie.
It made tons of money, and so it may have been a wildly unnecessary pumping up of the hype machine. But the rival people behind Screaming Live are suing, claiming that those pre-sale figures were fake, and that that meant they didn't get screens that they should have. In fact, their fans were frustrated because of the lack of screenings. Now, who's behind this? Well, the culprit is the ticketing platform Myoen. Think Fandango, I guess, right? But it turns out they're also a producer and distributor of the film.
Myoen, yes.
Yeah, and so 6 years ago, more than 90% of all tickets in China were bought at the box office. People would show up and buy a ticket. Today, more than 92% of all tickets are sold online via a handful of companies like Myoen and Dao Piao Piao. So, this, I think, is why Hollywood is wary of MoviePass. They don't want somebody in between them and the customer. They don't want somebody that can produce a movie, hype a movie, talk about ticket sales, direct people to their own movie rather than someone else's. I mean, it just makes life very unnerving for them, doesn't it?
Yeah, and I don't know, do you want to talk about MoviePass now?
No.
Or do you want to wait until we're done with box office?
Let's wait till we get done with box office.
All right.
Oh, but Eugenio Derbez, I should have mentioned, he signed a TV deal with Lionsgate. They're producing both Spanish and English language fare with him. So they are in bed with Mr. Derbez because they realize he's a big star.
Well, through Pantelion, they have been producing some of his films for a while now.
Lionsgate?
Yes, I believe Lionsgate was. And now they signed a big. But it seemed like they were behind How to Be a Latin Lover.
And now they signed a big TV deal with him to do TV fare.
Yes.
So now they're doing a TV production deal. So back to the box office, that number 11 is Wrestler. I have no idea what country this is from or what it's about. It grossed $3.4 million, whatever it is. And if you know what this movie is, it's being distributed by Lotte, L-O-T-T-E is the abbreviation. If you know anything about this movie, let us know.
Yes, you can email us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can also follow us on Twitter, where our handle is @showbizsandbox. Or you can like us on Facebook, facebook.com/showbizsandbox. All of that information is on our website, showbizsandbox.com.
That's right. At number 12 is I Am Your Mom. This is a Chinese sort of drama. I think it's sort of a Lady Bird type movie. It grossed $3.2 million, and it's about a teen headed to college who realizes she misses her mom more than she ever thought she would. It's directed by Xiao Chang, and it stars Ni Yan of A Woman, A Gun, and A Noodle Shop. At number 13 is Isle of Dogs, the Wes Anderson animated film. That's at $55 million worldwide. Steven Spielberg's movie is right behind that. That's about to hit the $575 million target worldwide. Below that is the French action comedy Taxi 5. That's at $34 million worldwide. And then there's Blockers, another $2.3 million on the weekend. That passed the $85 million mark worldwide. Right below that is the Jason Reitman film Tully, starring Charlize Theron. That's at $8 million in North America. And as one reviewer pointed out, boy, Jason Reitman seemed like he was the man early on. You know, he did Juno and then the terrific movie Up in the Air with George Clooney. And ever since then, his movies have been just sort of interesting, but they're not really catching fire with critics or audiences. It's a shame because I still have hopes for him, but you felt like he was turning into a really significant director, and now he's just sort of off in this cul-de-sac somewhere. At number 18 is the Indian comedy 102 Not Out. It's about a really, really old man. He's 102 years old, and he's waiting to become the oldest person in the world. I guess he just got to wait for other people to die. And he's being watched over by his grumpy 75-year-old son. Stars two big stars from Indian cinema, Amitabh Bachchan and Rishi Kapoor. It's a Hollywood-backed movie. One of the movies that Hollywood has backed in India. They're showing good success when they try not to do Bollywood movies, but more, you know, offbeat fare than you know, trying to copy the blockbuster stuff that works in India. They're working better when they do stuff that has social meaning or is a little off-kilter.
So, narrative, you know, like more straight drama. Yeah.
And comedy. Well, this is a comedy, yeah. This grossed $2.2 million, and it's at $9 million and counting. And number 19 is the Ashgar Farhadi movie that was the opening night film at Cannes. That's opened up, I assume, in France. It grossed $2.1 million. Your impression from Cannes, Spring, was that people liked it okay, but it's not his best movie, but, you know, it's good. My impression from here was that people really didn't like it at all.
Yeah, I mean, certainly I could see you saying that because it, Ashgar Farhadi, he has two Oscars, okay, for Best Foreign Language Feature for Separation and what was it, the play?
The Salesman.
The Salesman, yes. It's about a play. Then you have, Javier Bardem starring in it. It's basically Oscars all over the place. Penelope Cruz starring in it. And it's not as good as some of his previous films, but it's not at all a bad film. It's just, you know, people expect a whole lot more when you've got that much talent going into it.
Well, you expect hopefully one of the best films of the year, and it's not, right?
No, I wouldn't say that it's one of the best films of the year, no.
Right, so there you go. Number 20 is Black Panther, another $2 million on the weekend. $1,342,000,000 worldwide, which means it has been passed by Avengers Age of Ultron. It's at $696 million in North America. So I think with the success of Age of Ultron, that's keeping Black Panther sort of in the top 10, I think, in North America. Is it still in the top 10 this week? It's at number 9. So I think it's going to claw its way to $700 million in North America alone. Wow, that's a lot of money. Looking down on the list, the Italian film Loro Part 2 has opened up. That's the part 2 of the Paolo Sorrentino biopic of Silvio Berlusconi. That's grossed $1.3 million on its opening weekend in Italy, I assume. The Bruce Willis Death Wish remake, that unnecessary film has opened up in another territory. That's at just about $50 million worldwide. And at number 25, right at the bottom of the list, is I think it's a French film. It's called Mr. I Know Everything, a.k.a. The Michael Gilt Story, and that grossed $1,140,000, which raises a point, because in North America, RBG, the documentary about Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, hit the top 10 in the U.S., which is very exciting. That doesn't happen a lot for documentaries, and it grossed more money than that. So it should be on this chart at number 25, because it grossed $1.16 million. So if you, again, like we said before, if you know a film in your territory grossed over $1 million or worldwide grossed more than $1 million and it's not on this chart, you know, send us a link, send us a line, and we'll pay attention to it. We'll bring it to the attention of ComScore if we can, and we'll check it out. Make sure we mention it next week.
Now, do you think any of these films, certainly the ones that are playing in China, do you think any of them will play in smart cinemas? It almost sounds like you go to the cinema and it just knows what you want to watch and just immediately starts playing, there's a list of films that you want to see on the marquee.
It's not that at all.
Oh, darn it. Okay.
No, but this is a complete collapsing of windows. In China, they say, hey, look, there are a lot of, even though we're growing lots of movie screens in the country, there are still lots of villages and places where they have none or very, very few cinemas. And there are a lot of people who'd still like to go to the movies. So let's set up smart cinema. Basically, you buy a ticket, just like you would if you went to the box office. It counts towards the movie's box office, but you get to watch a movie streaming onto your phone. So instead of waiting for the movie to reach your territory, which it never will, and I don't think you have to be in one of those isolated areas. My sense is that you could be in Beijing and do this, but maybe they block it out by location. I haven't read that. But they're just saying, hey, maybe it's a small art house film, just like in North America. But this also includes, I think, big blockbuster Chinese movies. They're saying, hey, if you want to, you can just buy a movie ticket, and then we'll let you stream it on your phone once. Why you'd want to do that if it's Avengers Age of Ultron, I can't imagine. I can't imagine Hollywood would allow that, but I haven't heard anything yet about what's being blocked or what's not being blocked. But it's a complete collapse of the windows. You pay full ticket price, it counts towards the box office. China makes 900 movies a year, and more of them are getting a nominal or no release in movie theaters. And they're saying this is a way to reach more people who can't get to a cinema or are never going to bother.
Yeah, I think that certainly Hollywood would not go for this at all, if only because they can't control the piracy issue.
Well, they're saying, of course, it's a 2K image, it's DCI compliant, it's going to be completely copyrighted and protected, blah, blah, blah.
Wait, so a DCI on a cell phone? That's impossible.
That's what they said. That's according to a Variety story that they claim. And it's a former Wanda exec is launching this service called Smart Cinema. Gets away with Windows completely. And I'm assuming that any Hollywood movie released in China will not be available. They'll just simply say, you can't put us in that system.
Yes, right? Yes, that's absolutely true. They would not allow that. But or maybe they would try it and see what happens. I mean, you know.
Right. But again, this is, you know, it sounds crazy and ridiculous, but in North America, at least for art house films, it happens every day that movies are available on demand the same time they're available in cinemas in major cities, because a lot of movies don't go wide. So if you've got a movie at IFC in New York, it might also be available on demand even before it opens up in New York City. Right.
Now was RBG, the Ruth Bader Ginsburg documentary, released on demand as well as...
I don't think so, because that was that's a fairly wide release. I mean, that movie they're pretty excited by. So I don't know. That's on 180 screens right now. They just added some screens, about a 6,000 per screen average. But I don't know. There's no easy way to find out other than going onto your TV system and seeing if it's available. But that's a Magnolia release, so it's not IFC or Sundance or one of those people that we know often does on-demand releases at the same time. So I'm not sure about that. But, you know, I do know that I might go see the movie. I heard a friend who saw it the other day and said he liked it. And since I've got MoviePass, you know what? Why not?
Oh, okay. So, yeah, let's talk about MoviePass. We almost started to talk about them before, but let's talk about them now. So I don't even know where to begin, because it seems like every day there's something new that's happening with MoviePass. There's some new news that we need to report. And, you know, where do we begin?
Well, we begin with what we were yelling about last week when our great lost episode was that MoviePass has switched their plan again. They've gone back to their classic one movie a day option for about $10 a month. They got rid of it. They said, we may never do this again. And then they brought it back and they said, of course, we were always going to bring it back. And they also offer a second plan, which is their three movies a month plan plus iHeartRadio, a plan for $8 a month, a plan which I think absolutely nobody was asking for or wants. Right. I wish I could see three movies a month and buy iHeartRadio. It's such a ridiculous combination. But anyway, there's been stories that the parent company is running out of money. The stock was collapsing. It didn't hit its record low, but it did fall to 61 cents per share, which was way, way down from the 52-week high was $38. So the owners of MoviePass, Helios and Matheson Analytics, fell from a 52-week high of $38 to 61 cents. They had an earnings report or some sort of report where they had to announce some information, and they mentioned they had $15 million in cash, which is less than they need for their monthly costs. So that was concerning. And now the head of the company's come out and said, that's ridiculous. Don't worry about this. We've got plenty of money. We've got access to a $300 million line of credit. We are not running out of money. Everything is fine.
AKA, we're going to drive up the debt of this company to an unfathomable, unworkable amount, and then we're going to file for bankruptcy.
Before we get to the Cannes Film Festival, there's lots of films being announced there, of course, as always, and one of them I was kind of excited to buy, Bill and Ted Face the Music. In our reboot, sequels, and spinoff story, Bill and Ted is back. Keanu Reeves, Alex Winter, back together again, making another Bill and Ted movie. All the original creative talent is on board. They've just announced it at Cannes, but it is going to happen. After years of discussion, Bill and Ted are returning, dude.
I wonder, you know, they're a little bit older now, right? And as you get into middle age, yeah, they're quite a bit older. As you get into middle age, of course, you know what it's like, Michael, as a guy. You know, my middle is not as slim as it used to be. I wonder if they'll fit in the phone booth.
And that could be interesting. And it's not as funny when you're a dumb doofus when you're, you know, 20. Dude, not as entertaining when you're 40.
Yeah.
But we'll have to see. But that's just one of the many things happening at Con. And I think there's a big story. It has to be gender equality. That is really becoming the thing at the fest. We've seen women march on the Palais. I thought this was very interesting. I thought this worked really well, at least in the media around the rest of the world. Women got into a march and they put 81 women on the red carpet because they said that's the number of women who've been represented in competition at Cannes over the entire history of the festival. Just about 80 women have had a film in competition compared to 1,680 women, men rather, who've had a film in competition. So he said, look, we're not actually a minority in the population. We're actually a majority of the people on this planet, and we don't have even close to the same number of movies as men.
Yeah, so it was 82 women walked up the Monte de Marche, the red carpet, the tapis rouge, and for the evening screening, led by Cate Blanchett, the president of this year's festival jury. She was arm-in-arm with Kristen Stewart and Ava DuVernay, also jury members on this year's festival. And there was, you know, name the actress. She seemed to be there. I think Jessica Chastain may have been there. And, you know, then they read a statement and there was, you know, a little pause. And then they walked into the screening. But, yeah, that kind of there's, you know, pick your international the international tent, the little tent city that they have out there, mm-hmm. in the market. There's a film market and a film festival taking place at the same time. And in the marketplace, they actually have an international village with little tents representing each country. And they all have panels inside each one of them. And you can pick any single one of them. And they have some kind of, 50-50 by 2020 forum or panel taking place during the
and what is that and that's a pledge that the con top people just signed up on yesterday, I guess.
No, it was this morning. Thierry Frémaux, the director of the Cannes Film Festival, signed a pledge that diversity and equality will be represented in film festivals, and called for other film festivals to follow suit.
But what does it mean? I know in the terms of corporate America, it says, you know, we want 50-50. We want 50% of your board members to be women in the next 3 years. You need to make this happen now, not, you know, 20 years from now. We will increase, hopefully. And they're making pledges to do that. What actually are they pledging other than a desire to see it maybe happen, sort of?
I'm not sure, because it just happened. So I'd have to, go bone up on that, because it literally happened hours ago.
I think they pledged to at least release statistics to be clear about what is actually happening in terms of the festival in years past and this year. Keep record of it. You know, once you have numbers attached to things, then you start to notice and see, are they going up? Are they going down? So they have to be more specifically clear about not just saying, look, we have another woman on our jury this year, but saying what percentage of the jury have been women on all the juries, what percentage of films in every section are directed or produced by women, and making those numbers transparent and keeping track of them. Because once you write them down and pay attention, you start to notice that, oh, it's a little embarrassing, and then you change it.
Yes, and this year there are only three films directed by women in the official Cannes Film Festival competition. There are others in En Certain Regard, or the Quinzaine des Réalisateurs, or Directors Fortnight.
Well, perhaps there was a panel at the Saudi Arabia tent in that international cinema section where you go and hear each country tout what movie production is happening. They had a panel or something to tout movie production in Saudi Arabia. This is happening now. And they were not happy because they were grilled about women specifically in Saudi Arabia. They were grilled on women and LGBTQI issues. They said, you know, what if a movie is being directed by a woman? You know, women are just barely getting the right to drive in Saudi Arabia. And they were very unhappy with all these questions about what films could be included there. Could you bring a movie to be shot in Saudi Arabia that involved gay issues? Would that be censored? And they were just, why are you asking us this? Why is this so political? We just want to talk about movies. Stop asking us about women. But I was happy that happened, because frankly, you know, you're a studio and you want to, or a production company, you want to send out a message about gender equality, and you're going to take a movie to Saudi Arabia to shoot it there, a country where women, Jews, and gay people are not welcome at all. You know, what if a woman is raped on set? You have a female cinematographer, you want to send her to Saudi Arabia. If she's raped, and she reports it to the police, they will throw her into jail for adultery, for having sex outside of marriage. That's happened in Saudi Arabia. So how you can shoot movies there and claim you care about equality, you care about these issues, is beyond me.
So wait, I'm a little confused. You're saying that somehow the entertainment industry and Hollywood and might be actually, they might have double standards? I'm shocked.
I am shocked. I'm not shooting films in countries where your employees are not safe is not a typical procedure for Hollywood.
Well, I will say this. Unlike CinemaCon, where Saudi Arabia was a major topic, Saudi Arabia is not a major topic at the Cannes Film Festival. It's a topic that was, you know, yes, that particular panel got a lot of coverage on that one day, but then it's so far has been, you know.
I'm not saying it's the hot topic of the festival. I'm just saying I was glad it happened and it was good.
Okay.
I didn't say it was the news of the festival. I'm just saying it happened, and that's good, because those are the questions journalists and studios should be asking themselves and each other when they talk about doing business in countries where their employees are not safe and not welcome.
Okay.
But what else is happening with gender equality in Cannes? Anything else? Are the movies directors actually good?
Let's see. I'm trying to go down the list here, at least of official competition films. The film that right now is the front runner for the Palme d'Or, although only according to the press, okay?
Yeah, there's no such thing as a front runner,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, exactly. Is the Alice Rohrwacher. She's the Italian director. And Lazzaro Felice, Happy as Lazzaro. And unfortunately, I had to leave that film early to go see 2001 A Space Odyssey. And you might be asking, isn't that a 50-year-old movie? And yes, it is a 50-year-old movie. But Christopher Nolan, the director, is here. He gave a masterclass, and he brought a 70mm unrestored print. And by unrestored, he struck a new print with new elements to it. They found some original answer prints, some original negative, and they were trying to go back to photochemically what Kubrick had created in 1968, to which many said, hey, just maybe use digital for this because it did not look as good, and nor did it sound as good as...
Why wouldn't a new print of 2001 not look good?
Because
they struck a new print.
Yeah, because they're using elements that are flawed to begin with. So there were rips and tears in the images at times. There were, you know.
So the problem is not print versus celluloid. The problem is that he did not restore the film.
Correct. What I would say is go to digital, restore on digital, go back to finish on film.
And strike a new print on celluloid.
Correct.
Why didn't they restore it if they could see, all right, it's going to have scratches, it's not going to be a great image quality. I mean, people restore films every day. What was the point of striking a new print but not restoring it?
Purist. It's kind of
How is that purist? That's not purist.
No, look, this is one of the big things, the big debates after this whole, I don't want to say episode, but after seeing 2001 A Space Odyssey last night, which talk about, you've been to Cannes many times, Michael, and you know the Salle de Bussy and how many people it holds, and it was kind of a madhouse there last night for a 50-year-old movie. And it just didn't sound as good. And yeah, everybody is now saying, gee, you know, I think if you were trying to make a point, you may have actually done more damage than good.
But no, but what's the point? Nobody thinks old films shouldn't be restored. Everybody with any sense, I mean, restoring old films is not betraying the original intent of the director. People want you to restore old films and preserve them and keep them and clean them up. I mean,
if you were to hear Christopher Nolan say it in his masterclass, when you go from celluloid and negative and analog to digital, you're actually taking something away from the image that can never be put back. That is not accurate, but it is what he is saying, and it is what a lot of people then believe.
You mean to restore it in digital and then even to strike a new celluloid print, you're still losing something?
Yeah, you're losing fidelity, you're losing dynamic range. Those are all things that are not true.
So why not restore it via celluloid only?
That's what
he did. I
mean,
they used to do that, right? No, he didn't. He didn't restore it. He didn't do anything to improve the image and remove scratches or anything. Can't you restore a film without being digital? We did it before there was digital. We restored Lawrence of Arabia. We restored lots of movies before digital.
Yeah, I mean, you do it frame by frame with Q-tips and yeah.
So why didn't they do that?
It's still imperfect, whereas digital restorations...
No, but they didn't do that. They did not restore it.
No, I don't think they did that kind of restoration,
right.
No.
They didn't. They just struck a new print. They made a point of saying, we didn't try to restore the film. We just struck a new print.
Correct.
So I don't understand what point that makes. It's like, okay, if you don't restore a film, it's not going to look as good as if you do restore a film. And if you're trying to show off celluloid, not showing an old movie that's not restored isn't a great way to do it.
Yes, correct. Everybody, I think, left. But, you know, I got into this whole thing by saying I had to walk out of the Happy as Lazaro.
Yeah, why did you leave a new film that was good?
It's one of those things.
I hate leaving movies early. I never do it at Con if I can help it. Was there no way for you to see that film again?
Okay, so then it screened this morning at 9:30 opposite the 8:30 screening of Shoplifters, which is the Kurieda film, a Japanese film, and Kurieda, like Father, Like Son, and other films. And I, you know, a really touching movie about family and what family means. And you think that what I'm saying is all sappy, but it is done incredibly well. And as you know, Michael, Kurieda is very precise and his movies are slow burns, but they all build to something in the end. And it's worth sticking around for, even though you think, what the hell is going on here? And yet it's really...
So do you have another chance to see the Italian film?
Myself, Stephen Garrett, who works with Jump Cut Films and is here with the New York Observer, and he's writing a few things for Celluloid Junkie.
Let me write for Celluloid Junkie.
Feel free. You're absolutely more than welcome to.
Oh, I guess he's doing it for, okay.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and so he, we're hoping that there's a market screening, because we tried to go to the last half hour after the Kurieda this morning. They were like, we cannot let you in, je suis désolé. And you know, this year, I'm not going to get into the whole screening schedule, because that's really, you know, inside baseball of how the Cannes Film Festival has kind of reworked its press screening.
But it hasn't hurt you too much. Your general takeaway is it's okay.
It's okay for people like me. It's okay for people like Steven. If you're filing on a daily deadline, it's a pain in the neck. So okay. I can get that. But it's messed things up. The fact that they held a big gala screening or a big evening screening in the Debussy, the big theater here, or the second largest theater here, for 2001, and didn't premiere a new film or a competition film last night that also pushed movies around. So the screenings have all been kind of, it's like a log jam, so to speak. But certainly Happy as Lazaro is, people are liking the Jean-Luc Godard, which they screened three times for the press, despite the fact that I don't think anybody really needed to see it three times or wanted to see it three times, or, you know, there was a big demand to see it. The image book was as bizarre and crazy as every other Godard film has been over the last 10 years. Mm-hmm. And just to give you some sense...
We don't need any sense of the Godard. We got it.
Yeah, well, just this is, you know, it's basically him narrating over already shot...
Found footage.
Yeah. And he would translate like every third or fourth line into English in the subtitles. So, like, you were just like, whatever, I have no idea what's going on here, except if you understood French, like, I could understand what was going on. But, you know, I looked around, and the English speakers were like, you know what, they were all dozing.
All right, so basically, every year at Cannes, people say, Cannes is dead, it doesn't matter anymore, and they're saying it again this year, but they actually mean it this time.
Yeah, no, it is, there is a marked difference. There are, without a doubt, it is a much more subdued festival, very low key, fewer people here. I don't know about journalists. They always say there's 4,000 journalists here, and maybe there are, but it does feel half the people are gone, or there's only three quarter of the people here. On Saturday night, yes, there were a lot of people in town, but after that, you know, you can walk around the streets, and, you know, for the most part, it does not feel like the festivals did, you know, 5 years ago, even.
And we don't care. I don't care, at least, about parties. I never try to go to parties. I don't try to get into parties. I don't care how many celebs show up for the red carpet. I don't care about Amfar. I mean, I care about Amfar. I'm raising money to fight AIDS. But I don't care about any of those extraneous events. But if you walk along the beach and you can see all the tents where there used to be parties and people shoving to get in, that's not happening. There's no excitement there. There's no glitz there. And it doesn't feel cyclical. It feels like an end of an era. That's what people are saying.
Yes, it really does. It feels like, okay, this event is no longer of importance, is no longer relevant as much as it was in the past. The big ads that you see outside the Hotel Carlton for the latest, biggest, you know, Hollywood blockbuster that's going to come out in the summer, they're gone. Which, I mean, that's kind of telling unto itself. And as you mentioned, yeah. Michael, I don't go to the parties. You know, I am too busy.
We can't get in.
Well, okay. truth be known, that's really why. Those parties are just like, they're like salt and pepper to this festival. They're, you know, they're part of the milieu. They're part of the little ambiance. They're like, you know, you just kind of sprinkled throughout the festival and they lend a festive air to this event, even if you're not going to them. That is all gone this year. There's maybe one or two parties.
And there's one big Hollywood movie, and it's the Han Solo movie, and it's already opened in L.A.
Yeah,
I mean, it's already had a... That was bad.
Yeah, that is telling, because here they are kind of saying to us as journalists here in Cannes, hey, we can't show you the film anymore in the morning before it screens in the evening, because we want the premiere to be the premiere, the first time everybody in the world sees it, period.
And we're only going to allow world premieres in competition. No more movies that have played at Sundance or anywhere else.
Correct. They also said that. And a couple of years ago, you might recall, actually now it's, I think, 10 years ago, they said, hey, we want Indiana Jones and the Crystal Skull to premiere here. And Paramount said, okay, but we want to premiere it in Los Angeles first, in New York first. And Cannes said, absolutely not. There was a big back and forth fight over it. And so they premiered in New York and LA. New York, LA, and Cannes at the same time. But the entire cast was in Cannes. So it was a big, you know, to do there. This time, Disney has so much power, they basically said, yeah, we're premiering it a week before it screens in Cannes. Too bad, so sad.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you asked me before we started recording about some other films that I liked. I would mention the Egyptian film Yomadine, which is about a leper whose wife dies, and I know that sounds very bleak, but he goes on a quest through Egypt to find his family, because he was kind of dropped off at a leper colony and has never seen his family again. He was dropped off as a child. He goes with an orphan, and it's a very touching, very well-made, well-crafted film.
Oh, that's the leper movie. I've heard that's one of the best movies at the fest, yeah.
Yeah. Three Faces, the Jafar Panahi movie, I liked. It's, I've heard people kind of go, but talk about a film that deals with women's issues. Certainly that film does. It's about an actress who goes to find somebody she believes committed suicide in the rural countryside of Iran.
You mean find the body?
Well, she believes this person committed suicide because they sent her, she's a well-known actress, they sent her a text message with the video of it, and it's all, I'm not going to give away anything else.
You mean she's just trying to find out what happened?
Right, exactly.
Okay. And what about The Corrietta?
The Corrietta is a very beautifully made movie. It's a good movie. It's a very solid movie, but it's very subdued. You know, it's very Japanese and subdued.
No, I'm just saying, is that one of your favorite movies of the festival?
So far, yes. It definitely
And would
is.
It be on your best of the year list? How many of these would be, do you think, on your best of the year list would be worthy of that?
Ooh.
One of them? Two of them?
Yeah, maybe one or two of them. Certainly Happy as Lazaro very well might. And certainly, oh, you know what would? Cold War. Okay, this is a film by the director of Ida, or ID, Ida, depending on how you want to pronounce it.
The Pavel Pavlovsky film?
Yes, he won the Oscar for Ida. And this is a film that takes place from 1945 through, I think, the 60s. And it's a, unrequited love affair, or it's requited, but it's, an impossible love affair through the decades. And it is just so beautiful and so well done and so well acted and ends right when it should. It's just a very well made, touching movie.
Well, you know, there's a lot roiling Khan. They made a lot of changes this year. We heard Terry Frimo almost got fired for letting Netflix into the festival. They practically fired him, almost lost his job last year. And so that's why the clampdown on Netflix and films that aren't going to be screening in France. But that's obviously blowing back in them a little bit. Netflix wants to make good. Khan wants to make good. They don't have the glitz anymore. They're not a good Oscar platform, but they never were. So, you know, I guess the idea is, all right, you're not going to have Hollywood blockbusters keen off of Khan. That doesn't work anymore. You're not going to have movies that Hollywood believes are Oscar potential movies. You're going to have to be a festival that discovers movies, just like Sundance, just like South by Southwest, just like all of them. You're going to have movies that they don't know are Oscar potential, but get discovered and celebrated by critics. So it's sort of going to be, go back to your roots, be a film festival where you discover directors and discover talent.
Yeah, now, one, you know, down the Croisette, the main strip here along the beach in Cannes, there is the director's fortnight, the Quinzaine des Réalisateurs. And it is, it's got some great stuff this year. It's, you know, almost better than the official competition, it would seem. It's got the Deborah Granik film Leave No Trace, which premiered at Sundance and was a big hit at Sundance, okay? The reason I bring it up, this is the only reason I bring it up, is I could talk about To the End of the World, which is a film that takes place in Indochina, Vietnam, 1945, it's a gruesome film, by the way, and it's a film that, well, it's not for the weak-stomached, let's put it that way. I could talk about the gambling film Treat Me Like Fire.
Well, are they one of the best films of the year? You know, I mean, I don't care where it plays in the festival. If you've got three movies that you see at Cannes that end up on your best of the year list, that's a good Cannes.
Yeah, I'd have to say Treat Me Like Fire is good. But the film that we're going to be talking about, not this week, but probably in future weeks during our box office segment, is called The World Is Yours. And it's by Romain Gavras, Costa Gavras' son. And it is just such, it got the biggest applause at this year's festival that I've seen. It's straight on heist film. It's you could easily see an English language remake being done. It's so much fun and so, you know, narrative driven. It's
Vincent Cassel stars in it, right?
Yes. And
it's a great genre flick.
Yeah, it's really, really good.
They describe it as a comedy.
It, you know what? It's like an action comp. Yeah, it's like all of a sudden there are like really funny bits in it. But, you know, Gavras is a music video director. He directs Kanye West videos and kind of well connected on that front. And he's visually stylish. And it was good. It was really good.
Well, that sounds like a lot of fun, and especially at Cannes where you see serious, weighty films, to see something fun and exciting is always cool. So, you know, again, if that's, will that be on your best of the year list, do you think? Do you think, wow, that was a blast of a movie?
It's more of a Hollywood-type film.
Well, if it's good, I understand Hollywood, but that doesn't mean it's either it's good or it's not.
Yes, it was good. So it would probably be, you know, in the top 20 at least.
Okay. And, you know, I hate to say a film, our highest compliment should not be, it could be remade in English.
Yeah. And everybody has been saying, you know, as much as we shouldn't be saying that, we all look at it and go, you know, this could totally, there could be an English language remake of this.
Well, it's not up for the Palme d'Or because it's in the director's fortnight. So it won't be going for that top prize. And nobody will be going for the top prize of the Nobel Prize in Literature this year either.
Yes. I guess that brings us to our book filter segment. Now, this week, are you going to be giving us something to read?
I am not. I'm behind on my books this week, on my sorting through the books. There's lots of good books, as always, but I didn't get around to it.
Well, I know, as you mentioned, they're not going to award the Nobel Prize in Literature for 2018. They will award two prizes in 2019. Bob Dylan is hoping to win both of them, actually. Steve, that was a joke, by the way. Feel free to laugh. First time that the prize has been skipped since World War II. And that Nobel Prize, I forgot who it went to, but it's the eighth time in history that it has not been handed out.
If they skipped it, it didn't go to
anyone. No, the next year, the following year, sorry.
Well, they skipped it for years, 3 years in a row. Okay. So, yeah. So this is the eighth time in history they have not handed out a Nobel Prize. It's the first time next year where they'll give out two prizes in 1 year, which means next year in 2019, Philip Roth can be disappointed twice.
Oh, that's great. Okay. So yeah, he can sleep in.
And of course, the Nobel Prize in Literature is being delayed because of the Me Too movement, sexual misconduct scandal involving the Nobel Prize committee that has thrown them into disarray, which segues right into our sexual misconduct section. A lot of lawsuits this week. Ashley Judd is suing Harvey Weinstein for harassment and for torpedoing her career since, you know, director Peter Jackson publicly said, hey, I was going to put her in The Lord of the Rings, and Harvey Weinstein's company said, hey, don't work with that one when she's a pain in the neck. But that was really just retaliation because she wouldn't sleep with him.
Right, and it's actually the first time where somebody can say there is a monetary value to what you did. So you know, there was sexual assault and sexual harassment.
Well, it's not the first time people lose their job.
Yes, yeah. You're right.
There's plenty of cases. Yeah.
Yes. I mean, in this whole Me Too Hollywood movement where somebody
I doubt it's the first time, but yeah, people lose their jobs or they leave their job or they don't feel that they don't get a raise, they don't get a promotion, you know.
Right.
It's not the first time, but it's a good damn good case.
Yeah, because it's so obvious. I mean, Peter Jackson did say that, and he would have cast her in one of the most, biggest films of all time, biggest, you know, franchises of all time.
Yes. And Roman Polanski is suing. He's threatening to sue the Academy. They've kicked him out along with some other people. And my first instinct was, well, that's silly because the Academy doesn't have to let you be a member. But his lawyer says that there are new rules in January put in place that give members the right to appeal when being kicked out. The Academy people say, well, no, but there's other section where the Board of Governors can do this and you have no right. But at least there's some, you know, wiggle room there. So we'll have to see if he actually bothers to sue. I can't imagine because he's not going to end up being back in the Academy no matter what. So it just seems a kind of a pointless threat. But happy to take your money and bill you for hours, I guess.
Yeah, you mean the lawyer.
Yeah.
Well, and then there's NBC finally releasing their report of, I guess they're kind of clearing themselves of any wrongdoing in the Matt Lauer case, the Today Show host who was fired for sexual harassment. They said, no, we investigated it at the time and we did everything right.
Well, not at the time, but when it came to the light. Yeah. And they said nobody at Today or NBC News had any idea, which sort of counters that they said they officially did not know. Nobody officially made a complaint. And maybe that gives them a little legal wiggle room yet again, because NBC star Ann Curry at the time says when she was at Today, a female colleague said she was physically sexually harassed by Matt Lauer. And Ann Curry took that to the top people and said they got a problem. They need to watch this guy and do something about it. Perhaps that doesn't constitute a formal complaint. I'm putting that in quotes, at least symbolically. So maybe that's how they decided. But some people said, you know, you're clearing yourself. It's ridiculous. Some NBC people said, well, you know, the only reason to give it to an outside person is for, you know, appearance's sake. Well, yeah, actually, yes, that's true. But actually, an outside person is independent and therefore has a little more credibility. And in fact, the accuser of Tom Brokaw is refusing to cooperate with NBC because they're just doing an in-house probe. They said, you cannot clear yourself of wrongdoing. You need to have an outside person do it. If you do, we will cooperate with them.
Oh, that's interesting. I wonder why they went the in-house route with Tom Brokaw.
Or Matt Lauer. It's like, you can't clear yourself, you know? So I'm sorry, when it's making national headline news, that's not the time where you can do an internal investigation. Viacom certainly needs to decide what they're going to do. They've got an ugly lawsuit coming up involving Brad Gray, potential rape, sexual harassment. It involves multiple people, multiple executives. It's this guy, Rovier Carrington, who is a Hollywood royalty, is the great grandson of Mo Howard from the Three Stooges. He's a good looking guy. He's wealthy. And he was trying to get in the business. And he says he was raped by Brad Gray, who, of course, adamantly denies it. He refused.
Well, just to say, this is posthumous because Brad Gray died last year.
I beg your pardon. He refused to sign a non-disclosure agreement and claims he was then blacklisted. Then eventually he felt like he was getting back into the industry a little bit, getting a little traction again. And then he says he was sexually exploited by Brian Grayton of Logo, an NBC Viacom cable channel. And then in that case, he signed a production deal in exchange for signing an NDA. Feels like he was tricked into that. They never had any intention of doing any production deal with him that would lead to anything. And he says all along, Viacom was in the know. So it's a very ugly, very difficult case. Big lawsuit. We'll have to see if that goes anywhere. You know, one thing is the culture changing at all, and that brings me to our last story, and that's that Lethal Weapon, the TV show, has been renewed for a third season by Fox.
Okay, now, and how does that relate to sexual misconduct? Michael, why don't you tell us?
It doesn't really, but, you know, Warner Brothers TV had a hit show on its hand, modestly so, with Lethal Weapon, a spinoff from the film. It was a decent hit in the U.S. and apparently a big hit overseas. You know, they don't like to talk about overseas numbers, but every time they talk about this TV show, apparently it sold really, really well in international markets. The problem was that the lead actor, Clayne Crawford, reportedly was a complete jerk on the set. I don't know how else to put it. He treated people poorly. Everybody hated him. People felt abused and harassed. They complained. He had to apologize. He had to turn over part of his paycheck to a fellow actor or a person on the set. But again, despite meetings with them and talking to them and going into some sort of therapy, they felt like his behavior was not changing. And that went on for two seasons, and everybody just got sick of it. And, you know, the show was doing well and they wanted to come back for another season, but nobody wanted to work with the lead actor. What would happen in the past? They would just suck it up. They wouldn't care if the lead actor was a jerk. They wouldn't care if they were, you know, being abusive to people, not sexual misconduct as such, but just an abusive jerk. But in this case, they recast the role. They finally got rid of him and put Sean William Scott in that role for season three. Warner Brothers TV did that. So Fox said, we're renewing the show. And, you know, this was a show that was making money. And in the past, actors who were big jerks and abusive and just treated people poorly, you know, that would just, you just look the other way. You would just let it happen. Not much less have them have, you know, therapy and do all these things and pay attention to it and then ultimately remove them from a hit show two seasons in. That just wouldn't happen in the old days. And so...
Well, in the old days, I wouldn't arrive in Cannes and have a notice in my inbox talking about how there's a sexual harassment hotline now, nor would I have to sign a promise at the American Pavilion that when I enter, I won't be sexually harassing people, which, by the way, I never did anyway. So, you know, I was kind of like, well, okay, I didn't realize that that was something I...
Was an option.
Yeah, exactly.
But so I think it's a really positive sign of a changing culture. Like when you let people treat the crew members and other actors like dirt, whether the director or the showrunner or a star, that leads to other stuff.
Well, you know, Charlie Rose actually, you know, people complained about Matt Lauer. They complained about Charlie Rose, sexual misconduct. He was fired from CBS. He was fired from his PBS late night talk show. In fact.
After decades of being a jerk and people looking the other way.
Right.
No, this is that. No, that's the whole point. The culture is changing now. He had decades where you couldn't complain about Charlie Rose. You'd feel worried about losing your job. And
right.
He could
this
get
was my
away
way of
it.
Trying to say that Christian Amanpour will be now doing a public affairs late night show, which will replace Charlie Rose's long-standing show.
That's right. It's going to be different. It's going to be a slightly different focus. But yeah, you don't get much more symbolic than that, replacing an old white guy with Christian Amanpour, an incredibly respected, terrific journalist discussing world issues. So that's a big improvement.
Speaking of big, it's time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story, the isolation of R&B star R. Kelly is growing. He's faced years of detailed accusations about bizarre and disturbing treatment of young women, with some of them claiming he's essentially... He's running a cult in which young fans who come under his care give up contact with the outside world. The complaints have become harder to avoid as more women come forward, and it's finally enough for Spotify. For the first time, the streaming service says a new hateful content or conduct policy has led them to stop promoting R. Kelly. They won't include his music on their playlists, and they won't promote any of his music via algorithms and the like. His music does remain available on the service. They just won't tout it any longer. Big deal or big whoop.
Well, I think it's a big whoop. It's kind of an interesting step forward for them. And in fact, it's not just the content of the music, but they're saying we've decided his public behavior is such that we are not going to promote his music. You know, it wasn't because some song lyric. It was because of these news stories about his, you know, his public conduct. So your music may be fine, but if you attend a, you know, white supremacist rally, they might say we don't want to promote your music anymore. But it does show that they have a lot of power and that, you know, this is a modest, reasonable step. They don't have to promote his music. They're not removing his music from their service. They're just saying, we're not going to, you know, shout it from the rooftops that we got R. Kelly, and we're not going to put him on our playlists, and we're not going to say, hey, check out this R. Kelly song. So, you know, YouTube could do the same stuff. It's not that hard.
The cast of the sitcom Arrested Development is up in arms. Not over the inclusion of Jeffrey Tambor. The fifth season had begun filming, or was about to, when allegations against Tambor first surfaced on Transparent. You might remember that. No, they're mad, the cast of Arrested Development, because the fourth season of the show has been fiddled with. Originally presented as 15 episodes, the season focused on individual characters for the simple reason that the cast wasn't available to film a lot of scenes together. They weren't available at the same time. But now creator Mitch Hurwitz has re-edited the episodes, turning them from, 15 standalone episodes into 22 episodes where storylines overlapped. Hurwitz kind of did it to see if he could, as a comedy experiment, but he also did it because that adds 7 new episodes to the series total, with the 17 episodes from season 5 debuting on May 29th. The show's total is now 92, just about enough to sell it into syndication. The cast said, "Hey, that's awesome, but you pay us per episode, and if you're taking our work and creating 7 additional episodes out of it, we'd like pay commensurate with that." Fox said, "Can't you just be happy we're making new episodes? Why do you have to be so negative and focus on, money?" Okay, they didn't say that, but they do wonder, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
I think it's bizarre that Arrested Development, the idea of that show in syndication, that would get would that move the dial in syndication? I can't even imagine.
Well, isn't, who's doing this? It's Netflix, right?
Well, but yeah, but that's not the issue. They're not the ones recutting the episode so that they can do it in syndication.
No. What I'm saying is...
That would be Fox. Netflix orders some new episodes, but that's different from the re-editing of episodes to make it available for syndication. But shows still do get stripped. They still make money. Not typically a show like Arrested Development, more like The Big Bang Theory. Or The Middle. Those are more pure syndication plays, shows that play well out of order and have a bigger, broader audience than you would typically imagine with Arrested Development. But I guess there are cable channels and people that do want to strip it still, so that was interesting. You just don't hear a lot of talk about syndication as much anymore, not in this day and era of streaming and on-demand and all that sort of stuff. But hey, it's still an area where people can make money, which brings us to Rick and Morty, a really well-liked show. It's on Adult Swim. It's a cartoon, but hugely popular. Rick and Morty is the number one comedy for millennials. That's of every show. Big Bang Theory, Roseanne, you name it. It's the number one comedy for millennials on broadcast or cable, right? And they've only got about 26 episodes already done. They've been making them slowly and carefully. They just got renewed for 70 episodes. That's almost more than double of what they've already made. So at the current pace of production, they could be making the show for another decade. That's a really big, they're just saying, hey, make 70 more episodes. We love your show. Take the time. We want them all. And they really are sort of thinking, 70 episode renewal plus 26, that gets them to just about 101. And again, that's sort of a magical syndication number for stripping. So
that gives you a year's worth of content, basically, is the reason for that.
Well, not a year, because 5 days a week.
Right.
That's not a full year. You know, that doesn't last you a year.
Yeah, that's
100
true.
Episodes.
You run it twice
right,
a year.
But it lets you run them enough that it doesn't feel like you're repeating the same episodes all the time. So it's just an interesting thing. All you used to think about was getting to that 100 episode. That was all anybody cared about. Now with international and streaming and all that, it's sort of faded from the background, but it still matters.
Now the jukebox musical Motown, remember that, Michael?
I do.
Yeah, well, it's ending its touring production in North America after 4 years on the road. It would seem that Motown was in Los Angeles every other week, I have to say. The story of the fabled record label Motown opened on Broadway, closed while still going strong, by the way, and planned to return for a sit-down. Now, at the time, Michael, you and I said, that doesn't seem like a good idea. Well, that made the show seem like yesterday's news, and the return to Broadway ended in less than a month. But that didn't stop the show on the road. It will have played to more than 5 million people in the U.S., as well as 120 cities, before it shut down. It's going to shut down in June. Now, in the U.K., Motown the Musical is doing even better, hitting its third year in the West End with a national tour to launch in the fall. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal. Just like the initial box office is not the end of the story for a movie's profitability. You know, even if you don't triple your budget, you can still become a profitable film. That's even more true for shows on Broadway. You have a good run on Broadway. You may not become a blockbuster, but you establish your brand. And then if you work as a touring production like Motown, you can make good money. So that worked for them. And last week while we were gone, the Tony nominations came out and they didn't help Motown, but a lot of shows really need help this year. The Tonys can really make a difference. The Band's Visit could really use a win as Best Musical, which it's going to get. My Fair Lady could use a win as Best Revival. SpongeBob SquarePants would like to get some love. Basically, they're all looking for either a big win, like Best Musical or Best Revival of a Musical, or they're looking for a great performance on TV. But with a weak season and not a lot of shows, the Tonys really matter this year. So it'll be interesting to see what happens when that all comes out.
Now, vinyl, we always talk about it. It's making a comeback. Well, not really. As we keep pointing out, vinyl sales are a drop in the bucket compared to streaming. But hey, who are we to turn our noses up at millions of sales? But keep it in perspective. The number one selling album in the U.S. in 2017 was Sgt. Pepper, and it sold 72,000 copies, okay? Get that. 2017, okay? That was the number one selling album in the United States. That's absolutely remarkable. Still
on the vinyl format, in the vinyl format.
Yes, still, you know, vinyl is social, and it's fun, and it can sound good, and you know, that's why Christopher Nolan is always touting it. Oh, wait, no, I'm sorry. That was celluloid. Cassettes have also gotten some hipster cachet lately. And now, get this, here comes the 8-track tape? Nope. It's reel-to-reel, the audiophile format of choice, at one point in the 1970s, but never a dominant player. Well, a German company is producing the first new reel-to-reel for consumers in decades, but it won't come cheap. The basic model has a price tag of, get this, Michael, $11,000. Big deal or big whoop?
I'm going to say big whoop, but I will tell you this, it's going to sound great. Because when you spend $11,000 on a stereo system or just one piece of equipment, whether it's vinyl or cassette or reel-to-reel, yeah, it's going to sound good. Like, thank you, Neil Young. Yes, when you spend a lot of money on speakers and a turntable, vinyl is going to sound awesome. I remember reel-to-reel back in the 70s. I saw a few people with it, and I always thought, what the heck is that? But, you know, if it's well-done and well-made machine, it'll sound good, but it's not going to make a comeback, that's for sure. But, you know, think about this. Total vinyl sales in the U.S. hit 14 million last year, and they're charging like $25 an album. You know, so it's good money. They're making money on it. It's just, you know, in the U.K. they sold around 3 million copies of vinyl. Just don't get confused into thinking it's actually a big format. You know, digital streaming is where it's at.
Yeah, you know, one of my daughters, somebody that's in the band, the, you know, orchestra that she participates in middle school, I said, oh, who's that kid with the pink hair? You know, she looks kind of wacky. And, you know, I got her name and she's got this YouTube channel. And part of what she does on her YouTube channel that like all of five people watch is she like, you know, talks about the vinyl, the latest, the vinyl of the day. And I'm like, you're like 14. Okay. What are you doing with vinyl?
That's cool.
Well, you know, just because we're running long, we're going to wrap up Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and move along into Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. And if you live in China, this story really affects you.
That's right. It's a tale of two theme parks. Like the last 2 weeks, Shanghai Disney announced one of the fastest expansions for a Disney theme park in the world. Fastest they've ever done. They're going to open up Toy Story Land at Shanghai Disney. That's been open up for about a year and a half and is doing great. And they announced we're going to expand. In contrast, Wanda opened up a sprawling movie studio complex and theme park in Qingdao, basically the Yawns. It's sort of what's going on here. For a while now, Western theme parks are flourishing in China, but China-owned theme parks are collapsing almost literally. So what's happening here?
Well, Adam Minter had a story in Bloomberg, and, you know, I'm going to just read this. He says, as far back as the mid-1990s, large-scale theme parks began opening in China's bigger cities. Now, by the early 2000s, smaller ones were a common sight across the country. The ones I visited, and this is Adam Minter writing, the ones he visited around that time featured imported secondhand rides, questionable safety, and middle-class families keen to entertain their only child. Of course, remember, there was a one-child policy in China. But it wasn't long before the business began to professionalize and expand. By 2016, China's roughly 2,700 theme parks, that's absolutely astounding, they were attracting more than 200 million annual visitors and $4.9 billion in revenue, yet only 10% of those theme parks, so what, 270, were profitable. The problem was that most operators weren't interested in fun. Instead, they were interested in the land underneath them. This was thanks to well-intentioned public policy. In the early 2010s, local governments offered to reduce the skyrocketing cost of land for developers willing to build parks and other civic amenities as part of broader real estate developments. And you might be wondering, how the heck does this have anything to do with entertainment? Well, get this. You know who one of the big theme park owners was and theme park builders? Wanda Dalian, the same folks who own AMC Theaters, and they're opening the big Hollywood studio. Well, it's not a Hollywood studio; it's a $8 billion soundstage complex and theme park in Qingdao.
Right, they had hotels and theme parks all across China. They still do. They've sold off the theme park division, or the guy who owns Wanda sold off his theme park business. So suddenly, a lot of people were creating theme parks that didn't really care about theme parks. They just wanted the land cheap. And that just meant you had an explosion of cheaply done theme parks that nobody really cared about and wanted to see work. So oversupply didn't work. And we're wondering if it relates to the film business. First, you have a demand for theme parks. Then the Western countries come in and they do a better job. They're spending more money, bigger budget, and they're crushing it. All the big theme parks in China are Western. Yeah, so I'm just wondering if this is going to relate to movies. We were thinking a few weeks ago, gee, maybe China doesn't need Hollywood movies. The better they get at making movies, the less they're going to need Hollywood ones. That didn't quite work with theme parks that way. But when you compare them, Disney opened up Shanghai Disneyland. That was a $5.5 billion project. Compare that to one of Wanda's Wang, one of his biggest theme parks. That was a $500 million theme park in Wuhan. That has since closed. You know, when you've got a theme park that costs half a billion dollars and a theme park that has $5.5 billion, they're just not going to compare. The one is always going to, which one are you going to go to? You're going to go to the bigger one. I mean, it's not even a close call, right?
Well, it depends on pricing, remember.
Well, of course, but obviously they're pricing it right. If you look at the Shanghai Disneyland, they had 11 million visitors their first full year. It's the number 7 ranked theme park in the entire world in terms of attendance. It's the most popular theme park in China. And now they've got this Toy Story Land expansion. So clearly they're pricing it right. And people recognize that that's the value. Six Flags announced they're opening a major entertainment complex in Jiangsu. That's going to have a theme park and water park and adventure park. And in contrast, Wanda has this movie studio / theme park where, the big opening was sort of a big yawn. When they did the groundbreaking 5 years ago, a lot of big Hollywood celebrities were there. This time it was basically some bureaucrats.
Wasn't it like Leonardo DiCaprio and Catherine Zeta-Jones and all these people?
Exactly.
Gosh, I remember the list of headliners that went out there for that.
And I think the point of the theme park at this place is that it's not really a theme park. It really is a movie studio complex. That's what they care about. That's where their business can happen and work. They've got 30 film studios and post happening there. They have a shopping mall and hotels and a yacht club and a hospital. So they want, big studios to feel like they can come there and be taken care of in great surroundings. The theme park is not what's drawing Hollywood to there. That's a sort of a tag on, just like all the other parks that they've had around this country. I think what's going to make or break that development is the studio, not the theme park. And that's what happened with a lot of these things. It was the development they wanted, not the theme park. So we've had a weird bubble of theme parks. It's collapsed. A lot of them are shutting down because they're losing money. And now we're going to get back to the real times. Hollywood is doing theme parks. They're doing them well. And I think China's going to see them, copy them, and then do it better. If they do another theme park, I think it's going to be a multi-billion-dollar theme park. And they're going to do it with Chinese properties that Hollywood maybe won't catch on to as easily or have as much access to. And then they'll have the same success that Hollywood does, just like their movies are. But in the same way, I don't think China is going to outgrow the Hollywood movie, because there just aren't that many $200 million films being made. You know, they're not going to be able to meet the demand with their own movies, because there's only, you know, so many films of that size that you can make every year. So I think for a long time to come, Hollywood's going to have the movies, the theme park rides of a movie that China's going to want to see.
Well, speaking of movies that people want to see, I have to say one of my favorite films is Lawrence of Arabia. Okay.
Absolutely.
And the woman who won the Oscar for editing that film, Ann Coates, died at the age of 92 recently.
Yeah, she did. Great career. Sadly, the last movie she ever edited was 50 Shades Grey.
From Lawrence of Arabia to 50 Shades of Grey.
Yeah, that's kind of depressing. But, she had a great career. She did Lawrence of Arabia. She worked early on in the British industry. She did a little work on The Red Shoes, which she wasn't credited for. But then she broke out. She did movies like The Elephant Man, Out of Sight, What About Bob, Aaron Brockovich, and, of course, Lawrence of Arabia. 33 miles of footage is what they estimate they were dealing with when they were editing that film. I mean, that is crazy.
Think about it this way. That was shot on some big gauge, 65 millimeter stock, number one. Number mm-hmm. two, that was at a time in the 60s where there was none of this digital stuff where you edit with Final Cut Pro, or you edit with Adobe Premiere or an Avid. You were actually schlepping film cans around, and you were schlepping clips around, actual celluloid. Christopher Nolan would have loved it.
And in fact, it has one of the most famous cuts in film history. 2001 has obviously a famous cut from the bone flying up into the sky into a space station. In Lawrence of Arabia, there's a cut where Peter O'Toole is blowing out a match, and it cuts right to the desert sun. It's a famous shot, and Ann Coates often tells the story that would not have happened today. The way the film was put together, that snap cut, that bam from the match to this desert sun, happened because it was physical, and they were cutting film. And they might have adjusted later, but when they saw it, they went, oh, wow. And then they fiddled with it and made it work. But if they'd been doing it digitally, she said, we would have just, slow faded from one to the other. So it's one of those happy instances where, physical celluloid cutting of film led to one of the great moments in film history.
Yeah, because basically when you were cutting actual film, you would make a cut with, a splicer, and it would be cut in between the frames, and you'd end on one frame, and then you'd make another cut on another shot, and you'd literally scotch tape them together. It was, splicing tape, but still, it was a special tape, and it would be a snap. All of them were snap cuts, and then you'd have to mark on the print that you were editing whether you wanted a fade or a dissolve in and a dissolve out or a crossfade. You'd had to mark it, hey, this is going to be a fade, or hey, this is going to be a cross dissolve. And so now you just do that automatically. You say, yeah, I'm going to cross dissolve here to this other shot. So you actually do the transition before the shot.
Yeah, it's fascinating. And she's, did some great work. It's kind of exciting to start with Powell Pressburger back in the British film industry. And she said she became an editor because it was one of the few areas in film where women were flourishing, where women were allowed to do creative work and have a say in it. And in fact, she says, as editing was recognized more and more as a creative, exciting area, men came in there and elbowed women out of the way. She'd already established herself, but now we see men dominating that area of Hollywood where once women reigned supreme.
It all comes back to women, just like we started with Cannes and women, and so there you go. It all comes back to Cannes, maybe. I don't know. I'll be here.
There's more of them than us.
That's true. That is true. And you know what? There's more listeners than us as well. In fact, we thank you for listening, and we thank you for subscribing. Please do subscribe to our show in iTunes, the Google Play Store, the Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, anywhere they give podcasts away for free is where you can find us and subscribe to us and rate and review us. It does help us out when you do. links to those ways to subscribe to us, as well as ways to contact us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. Or you can call us and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can also follow us on Twitter, @showbizsandbox is our handle, or like us on Facebook, facebook.com/showbizsandbox. All of that information is on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll find links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode. Again, the website is showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Gilt has a website every week at something new and exciting. What is it this week, Michael?
This week it's rickandmortyforever.com. That's a good show.
Okay, I'm going to have to check it out now. You know what? If you can't find any of Michael's coverage of the entertainment industry there, why not head on over to michaelgiltz.com to read, that's where all of his work is aggregated, actually. Don't forget to check out bookfilter.com to know what you should be reading, what books you should be reading. Some of my work, especially the stuff I'm covering in Cannes, can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.